So, good evening, everyone, and welcome both those of you who are actually here in the Bishop's Villa and those who are joining us online, both our talk and our later discussion. Welcome to today's ZKF talk. My name is Dominik Steinhuber, but I'm not here to talk about myself. It's my great pleasure to introduce you to today's speaker, Dr. David Herring from the University of Liverpool, who is currently a guest professor here in our American Studies department in Konstanz. David Herring's scholarly pursuits extend to the realm of postmodern and contemporary literature, in particular the works of David Foster Wallace. Among his publications are his 2016 monograph, David Foster Wallace, Fiction and Form, and the edited volume, Consider David Foster Wallace, Critical Essays, from 2010, which is still a great book to come back to, as well as numerous articles and book chapters. But that's not all. David is not only an academic, but also a proficient writer of fiction. Now, at the core of David's current research project, Holding the Ghost, A Theory of the Contemporary, which is to be published with Cambridge University Press in 2025, lies an exploration of the many hauntings that define our political, ecological, social, and cultural landscapes. Drawing from the spectral turn initiated by Derrida's seminal work, Spectres of Marx, David argues for a new way to conceptualize and view the contemporary, one that approaches the presence of the past and possible future in the contemporary through a process of affectivity, sympathy, trauma, and preservation. But I don't have to tell you much about David's fascinating research because he's going to do so himself today. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Dr. David Herring with Haunted Objects and the Contemporary.
Thank you. Thanks, Dominik. Thanks, everyone, for coming today. And thanks also to everyone at the university who's invited me to be here for these last few weeks. It's been a really great experience. And I'm looking forward to talking a little bit about this book that Dominik's just described. What I'm talking about today is going to be a part of one of the chapters of the book, which is to do with haunted objects. There are other chapters of the book. I'm happy to talk a bit more about them later, but I'm concentrating particularly today on a bit of the first main chapter of the book. And I'm going to start with this skull. This is my starting and hopefully finishing point as well. It's jet black. It's been dyed or it's been painted. It's been repaired, it's been glued back together with gold lacquer, which highlights the places where it was broken. There's a name that you might know for this process. It's a Japanese word, kintsugi. It's an art whereby the fault lines of the repaired object, rather than being disguised, are made visible. And what kintsugi does is it foregrounds the effects of time on a given object, which is not the same as it was prior to its breaking. The visibility of its reconstruction brings our attention to its frangible qualities and enhances our understanding of its shape. So the skull here is a vessel intensified by its mending. But the effect here is different because kintsugi is normally used for ceramics or something like that. A skull is a different matter. A skull that's been broken and put back together, that's kind of different. Kintsugi suggests repair as an accentuation of an object's original qualities. But a human skull shattered and reconstructed in this way implies something more, something potentially deathly or catastrophic. So this meeting of death and decoration produces a kind of what we would call memento mori. So an art object upon which to meditate on the transience of human life. Now, traditionally, the memento mori has operated as both an ornament and a prop. So it's taken the form either of a real skull. People would have a real human skull in front of them, or a two or three dimensional rendering in paint or wood or stone. So if we look at the Are we able to get the slides in front?
One moment.
That's okay. What you'll see is we have a very famous Memento Mori painting, Vanitas, and we also have a physical rosary, which is carved out of, ivory, which is an example of a physical memento mori. So a memento mori that is kind of like flat still life is something that kind of suggests that that there is a quality of life that exists. So if we go there. So that's Philippe de Champagne's Vanitas from 1671, and the rosary beads here from 1520 to 1530. The rosary, the characters on the rosary beads get steadily more and more decayed as you turn them around. And then, of course, the painting is something that you look upon. The rosary beads are something that you physically hold. But despite being kind of graspable in the moment, if you think about those rosary beads, the object's ontological power is ultimately triumphant over you. Our ability to hold it is always temporary. The purpose of memento mori, remember you will die. You know, you are the object is going to outlast you. But there's just one problem here, which is that this skull doesn't exist. It's a photorealistic CG 3D sculpture, fractured skull, by the artist Rachel Chu, whose job is, she's a 3D animator. So when we first see Fractured Skull, maybe when you first saw it before, we imagine it to be an object we can physically hold, we can pick up, we can look at, that we can grasp, that we can rotate in our hand. But when we discover it's a digital rendering, we think about, maybe instead, about all the physical reference that served as a model for the CGI artwork, and therefore by extension, the life of the skull's owner. Maybe there was an original skull that was the prerequisite for this pretend CG skull. We think of the flesh implied by the presence of the skull. But maybe the skull itself doesn't have one single life referent. Maybe it's a composite of different images of skulls from many different digital sources. Maybe it's multiple skulls in a single object. So can we still hold this skull? Can we still grasp it memento mori-like if it isn't a real life object? Well, if we can't physically hold Chu's skull, well, if you think about the topography of the object itself, its edges, its adhesions, its connections, to its effects on our understanding of its temporality, we can perceive shared qualities that emerge between the object and us, the viewer. And these qualities are, in effect, held in the space between both. And this hold, as I'll call it, encompasses a dialogic relation to the skull. And this relation, I think, is full of potential. Now, it doesn't just make us think of the possible histories of the skull, be they real or digital, it also makes us think about how the flawless conjuring of that skull, which is fools everyone when they first see it, it might also prompt anxieties about the effacement of the human. So to hold the skull in as much as we can involves a kind of complex dialectical process. So to use a famous term from Walter Benjamin, the skull's aura is disputed. Despite the way that we conjure its human antecedent in our minds when we see it, it isn't ultimately possible to know whether it has an initial reference or not, whether it's preceded by the human or whether it's bypassed the need for the human. We think of the skull's history, but at the same time, we also think of our future. So Chu's skull then is a kind of haunted object. It's a twofold haunting, and it's temporally bidirectional. The ghost of the skull's possible referent, and then the effacement of the human that its automated or CG creation might imply. Now, obviously, a human has created it, but I will get onto a little bit later about thinking about artificial intelligence, AI images as well. So implicit in Chu's skull, then, it's not just a reminder of our mortality, like when we saw the old memento moris, but it's also contains an anxiety over human obsolescence, too. Now, an object is always haunted by something. It might be found, it might be made, it might be bought or given, but each set of circumstances infuses it with a field of relations. So the exchange of an object, in the words of Anne Carson, forms a kind of connective tissue between giver and receiver. Carson's consideration of the life of objects is based, for her, around the Greek words xenos, which can mean either guest or host, and xenia, meaning either gifts given or gifts received. And the example of xenia that Carson uses is, like Chu's sculpture, a human bone. So in ancient Greece, a bone would be cut in two and each person would keep half, and when they reunited, they would put the object back together again. And Carson says, a gift is not a piece broken off from the interior life of the giver and lost in the into the exchange, but rather an extension of the interior of the giver, both in space and in time, into the interior of the receiver. So, to follow that, I should say I'm not going to talk about the process of gift exchange today, but I am interested in how the life of an object can become infused or haunted with its history. So that etymology of xenos, that of the guest or host, is of course also tied up with the concept of haunting, in that it implies a relation of possession, of communication, of one somehow lodged within the other. Now, a relation to an object, to me, is always a relation to its mode of production, of the life of its former owner, of the person who manufactured it, of the person who lost it or was dispossessed of it. Ownership, says Walter Benjamin, is the most intimate relationship that one can have to objects. Not that they come alive in the owner, it is he who lives in them. That's a quote from his essay, Unpacking My Library. And it's this kind of uneasy ontology that I'm talking about here that interests me. The object's current owner may, in life or death, enter into a relationship with the next owner, one of a series of what we might call accretive spirits that infuses or surrounds the history of the object, a chain of possession and counter-possession. And Chu's skull problematizes that relationship in what I think is a really interesting way. So it's still an object created by a human, but its possible lack of human reference and the ability of digital technology to photorealistically replicate the physical object points towards a new question, or several questions. What are the materials of this skull? Is it the program that allows us to build these 3D models? Is it the circuit board in the laptop that hosts the program? Is it the minerals mined for the circuit board? How far back do we go? So as the object moves further from physical production materials, the chain of relations gets longer and more complex. So this is not an object we can physically hold, but we are nonetheless held within the series of relations that it generates. But we might also go further than that. It's now possible to produce an image of a virtually photorealistic skull by typing a prompt into an AI art generator. Now, the labor it takes to produce that work, which can often be generated in seconds, is almost completely invisible to us. It threatens the artist, not least from an economic position, with obsolescence. Why ask a human to produce an object when a machine can do it almost instantly and for free? The AI skull haunts us with more than simply an absent referent. It haunts us with the effacement and automation of our own labor. It promises, through a compression of all those histories tied up in a physical object, the loss of the object's xenia. Now, AI, of course, it's not magic, and AI generators draw from a vast repository of human-created imagery. But by some point, logic dictates that the AI images themselves will themselves form part of the repository. The program will, at least in part, be drawing from itself. And at which point might the human slip out of the relation altogether? Now, this is not a new phenomenon. If we think about humanity's fears over its effacement by technology, they've existed for as long as technology has itself. But there's something about the anxieties that attend this contemporary moment of agency, automation of labor, artificial intelligence that feels urgent. And I think this is because, for me, these anxieties have an associated counterpoint. So alongside this fear of human effacement is the anxiety that attends the superfluity of human objects, of too much stuff, basically, of what Maurizio Boscagli calls materiality out of bounds, which declines its role as the eternal sidekick of the subject. So that anxiety of the disruptive relation between human and object occurs in a sort of pincer movement, I'm saying. On the one hand, you've got the human will be replaced by an automated or physically identical artificially intelligent counterpart. On the other hand, humans and what they produce are all too present. We're drowning in a sea of unnecessary objects, unbiodegradable things that will never die, microplastics in the drinking water, fossil fuel byproducts choking the air. Now, in these scenarios, humans lose control accretively over our environment. Our centrality as owners or producers of objects, overwhelmed now by a surfeit of stuff that won't go away and around which we now have to adapt ourselves. We become subjects that serve the objects, which increasingly form networks of their own, chains of, in some cases, environmental or ecological breakdown. So how do we think about, usefully think about, all these modes of crisis? Well, the process I use to think about the ghostly in these texts is a term, and in the book that I'm writing, is a term that underpins that book, and I call it ghost holding. Ghost holding is a conceptual approach that borrows from, you know, I've mentioned Benjamin a couple of times. Really, Benjamin has been a really useful figure for me in trying to think about the structure of what I'm doing. And of course, Benjamin's dialectical image has been really useful too, that juxtaposition of the past and the present, by which one, as Benjamin says in English translation, grasps the constellation which his own era has formed with an earlier definite one, kind of knocking those two eras together and seeing what kind of emerges from that. And this allows us, I think, a chance to understand our present. But in a departure from Benjamin's model, I think that with ghost holding, the process is proleptic as well as analeptic. So for Benjamin, we look at the past to consider what it means now. But the ghost is unbound by time, and it puts time, in Shakespeare's famous formulation, out of joint. So ghost holding can be a seizing that reaches both backwards and forwards. And the constellation, to use Benjamin's term, incorporates both the known past and the perceived future. So in the context of what I've outlined with the skull, in the way in which our contemporary relation to the object incorporates both our understanding of its history, production, and ownership, and also our anxieties over its making us ghostly, this pro and analeptic process allows us to seize, hold, and make sense of this anxiety and provides us with a contemporary theory to our relation of the object. But before I get to more examples of this, I want to think through how this theory that I'm talking about relates to existing contemporary theories of the thing, of the object, and of stuff. Because there have been, in you know, the last decade or so, a preponderance of theories of the object, or more prevalently, the thing, around the turn of the 21st century, which marked a certain kind of intervention in the way that we think around our relationship to objects. And the most common two of these objects, they tend to be described largely either as thing theory, as object-oriented ontology, occasionally as actor network theory, and they tend to follow, this is a bit of a generalization, they tend to follow Heidegger, who distinguishes between an object, which has properties that are sensible to the subject and is necessarily distinct from it, and a thing, which is characterized by a relational dynamic to the subject. So, on this view, our relation to an object, a hat we wear, or a book we read, make it into a thing. Now, a key text of this movement, and one of the more extreme texts of this movement, is Jane Bennett's book, Vibrant Matter. Now, she describes herself as pursuing, quote, materialism in the tradition of Democritus, Epicurus, Spinoza, Diderot, Deleuze. It's quite a tradition. More than Hegel, Marx, and Adorno. Now, the iteration of historical materialism that I'm pursuing in my book, which comes at least partly, as I've said, via Benjamin, and is just more sympathetic to Marx and Adorno, differs from from Bennett's tradition, and indeed quite a lot of traditions of thing theory and object-oriented ontology, and I'd like to explain why. So, broadly put, thing theories, in general, have a relation to the object that seeks to center the object agency in a way that's distinct from the human subject. And these theories occupy a spectrum on which the object has progressively more and more autonomy from the human. So Bennett, as I said, is at the more extreme end of the spectrum. She considers things to have trajectories, propensities, or tendencies of their own outside of human entanglement. They have a sentience or vibrancy that is completely separate, that we can't know about from humanity. Bill Brown and Bruno Latour, two other theorists associated with this movement, acknowledge that they are actually initially drawing, at least in part, from a Marxist tradition. Brown, in particular, acknowledges the importance of Benjamin on his theory of the thing. Now, like me, these theories consider the object in the contemporary context of a dematerialization of the world, a proliferation of newly agential objects, and a recognition that our most familiar object, our planet, says Brown, has become uncanny. Unlike me, these thinkers describe a divergence from the idea of the commodity. Now, in Other Things, his book, Brown places himself in opposition to Lukács' claim, following Marx, that the character of things as things has been destroyed by the hegemony of the commodity form. Instead, he follows Heidegger's argument that the thing has powers that are comparable to those of the commodity object that Marx describes. In short, the thing has at least a degree of independence from the commodity for these thinkers. Rather than the two things being inseparably entangled, Brown suggests that the thing precedes the commodity form. So, and here's a kind of useful quote from Brown which helps us to kind of understand what he means there. I worked with the assumption that the doubleness of the commodity, divided into use value and exchange value, conceals a more rudimentary distinction between the object and itself, or the object and the thing, which in fact sustains the success of the commodity, in other words, the success of capitalism. Value derives from the appropriation of a pre-existing surplus, the material object's own excessiveness. So in other words, for Brown, the commodity is a secondary form. There's something thingy about the object itself, some inherent quality that precedes any kind of commodification. So Brown prioritizes an object-thing relation over a subject-thing relation. And this is where I disagree. So for me, the commodification of the object is traceable back beyond its formation. Commodification, for me, retrospectively captures all the raw materials of the eventual object itself. So if the object is itself some of these raw materials, their intended use in the object, once thought, can't be unthought. If the horizon of the commodity covers all past and future elements of the object as if it were a blanket that we throw over it. Also, the dematerialization of the world that Brown describes as the spur for the return to things seems strange to me. Brown approvingly quotes a historian as saying, quote, after the turn to discourse and science in the late 20th century, there is a new fascination with the material stuff of life. Now, I have two issues with this. One is that this phrasing collapses several critical and theoretical discourses together, including theories of the commodity, under a rather nebulous sense of discourse and science, which I presume I take to mean the semiotic theories that are associated with what was postmodernism. The second problem is that these disparaged approaches, you know, well, we were away from things for a long time, but now we're coming back to them. Those theories that are being dismissed there, I think, are actually profoundly interested in the object and the thing. I don't think you can imagine, for example, like, to take a classic postmodern example, Baudrillard's Loss of the Real and the Simulacra, without thinking about the importance of the object and the thing. So on my reading, objects and things never really went away to come back again. But I do agree with Brown that the dematerialization of the world and the uncanniness of the planet, which I think of as the waning of material networks in favor of the digital, and then the relation between the production of objects and the despoiling of the climate, is actually an important context in which to consider our changing relationship to objects. I think that is a really valid and important way in which to consider that. I'm going to show you a passage from Latour's book, Reassembling the Social, where he describes his concept of actor network theory and flirts with the concept of the ghostly object without fully committing to it, or the object invested with some kind of mysterious possessive force. This is from Latour. These implements, according to our definition, are actors, or more precisely, participants in the course of action waiting to be given a figuration. This, of course, doesn't mean that those participants determine the action, that the baskets cause the fetching of provisions or that hammers impose the hitting of the nail. Rather, it means that there might exist many metaphysical shades between full causality and sheer inexistence. In addition to determining and serving as a backdrop for human action, things might authorize, allow, afford, encourage, permit, suggest, influence, block, render possible, forbid, and so on. So I want to make a distinction here between the kind of ghostliness that he's using and mine. So like Brown, Latour aims here for a kind of, almost like a kind of mysticism of the object. It's this crucible of non-human potential that we may incorporate into broader networks of action. Now, I do share an initial sense of human object entanglement with Latour, but instead, I draw the ghostly element from the always existing gap between object and commodity that exists at the moment of its discovery or creation. That, for me, is where the ghostliness comes from. So in the texts I'm looking at in the book that I'm writing at the moment, and particularly specifically in this chapter, people are haunted by objects whose manufacture is made by turns both opaque and hyper-visible. But the point is that the manufacturing itself is central. The objects that haunt us in the contemporary are indivisible from their status as commodities. Their commodityness is part of the haunting quality, in that it affords us the analeptic view of their creation and the proleptic view of their dominance and possible effacement of us and our environment. So by holding on to these haunted objects, or by studying the networks in which they're embedded, we're able to perceive our relationship to them with more clarity. And in this relation, I'm broadly in agreement with Sarah Wasserman, who in her book, The Death of Things, there's the quote on the slide, seeks to move away from the idea of the animus of the object and towards its death or its effacement. And her book is about ephemera. So those objects that are designed to be discarded, but like train tickets or things like that, but which might nevertheless survive, be retained or archived, as a way into thinking about our contemporary moment. So Wasserman believes that ephemera illustrates our entanglement with objects. This is a really helpful phrase, I think, here. The vanishing object is constitutive of the enduring subject, not incidental to it, and that holding on to something obsolete reminds us of our own limited lifespan. Now, I want to take the scale of Wasserman's argument further. I think that this process of holding on to the dying or dead object she describes has a corollary in our relationship with the accumulation of stuff. So what we're holding on to is, of course, not necessarily the use of the object, but our attachment to it. And I think this needs to be perceived as occurring on a huge cultural, biological, economic spectrum. So at one end, the micro end, we have this pathological holding of objects around the individual that might characterize something like dysfunctional hoarding. While at the other end, we have humanity's continued dependency on rapidly eroding fossil fuels, a dependency that threatens planetary catastrophe. So both ends of that spectrum present a situation where holding on to something prevents us from being able to imagine a future without those objects. But at the latter end, the planetary end, the result affects everyone currently alive and yet to be born. So what I'm suggesting then is that when we're haunted by an object, we hold within our relation to it that micro-macro scale. The object's past meaning and its future domination, our attachment to it, and its catastrophic potential. Now, I want to consider something. If we're holding onto an object, where and how are we holding it? So what I've described is a relation that doesn't always involve physically holding onto something, but holding as a kind of relation. The object might have sentimental value, like a toy or a piece of jewelry, or it might have convenience value, like a car or the petrol in it. But our relation is not simply contained in wearing the jewelry or driving the car. It's the way that we hold the object in our awareness, even when we're not using it. The way that we hold an object that haunts us, for me, has some kinship. I think there's a useful way to think of it with Donald Winnicott's concept of the transitional object. And Winnicott uses the term to denote a transitional sight. He talks about it in relationship to the infant and the mother's body. So a sight for the infant that lies between the mother's body, specifically the breast, onto which the infant initially cathects, and then the external world of object relations. Now, when this object serves its transitional purpose, it's not forgotten, but the term that Winnicott uses is it's relegated to limbo. It doesn't go inside or become repressed like it does in Freudian melancholia. It's not forgotten, and it's not mourned. It loses meaning instead and becomes, Winnicott's word is diffused across the intermediate territory between inner reality and the world. And I'm interested in how he describes the object as being relegated to limbo, which is, of course, a kind of purgatorial or ghostly space. The diffusion that the object undergoes feels like a sort of melancholia, but it's not one that's held within the subject's ego, like Freudian melancholia is. It diffuses between things relationally. And this is how I perceive the way that we're haunted by objects and the way that we hold on to them. It's a kind of non-hierarchical diffusion. The Winnicott describes the transitional object as a possession, and I like that non-specific directional possibility in that expression. We possess and are possessed by the object. Okay, so much for the process then. How does this work in practice? I'm going to finish with a short close reading of a specific text, which is Ruth Ozeki's novel, The Book of Form and Emptiness, which came out in 2022, I think. Now, this is turns out to be an incredibly useful book for thinking about this. What interests me about Ozeki's book is its scale. It encompasses everything from Benjamin's concept of history to the effacement of the human by too much stuff. And it does through the motif of the haunted object, or at least the speaking object. Objects have a great degree of agency in this book. They speak, they have personalities and distinct idiosyncratic qualities. They kind of flirt with the vibrancy that thing theorists like Bennett describe. But this is also a novel profoundly entangled with the commodity form. So to briefly summarize, it's the story of a boy, Benny, who has lost his father in a road accident. And following his father's death, Benny begins to hear objects speaking. First thing he hears is his father's ashes, and then after that it's a series of everyday items. All of these objects, we soon discover, and all objects everywhere, have a voice and are in constant dialogue with each other, but Benny's bereavement has seemingly triggered an ability to hear them. Benny's mother, Annabelle, is a compulsive hoarder who works as a news monitor and archivist, and whose job is to siphon vast amounts of news data for corporate clients. Benny's condition means that he's committed briefly to a psychiatric ward where he meets a young woman, Alice, who associates with a group of eccentrics who believe in the importance of trash, some of whom believe that objects have their own sentience and agency. So that's the plot, basically. The novel is narrated doubly, firstly by Benny and secondly by the book itself, which is conscious of its nature as a book. And the book proposes that books themselves are, quote, rhizomatic networks. So in the earlier stages of the novel, the dominative narrative voice is the book. Then towards the end of the novel, the book's narration seems to synthesize more with Benny. It's not entirely clear whether we're supposed to think that Benny is the book, or Benny is writing the book, or that Benny has been writing the book all along, but we start to witness that Benny's voice becomes more confident and powerful. The epigraph of the book is taken from Benjamin's Unpacking My Library, and there's an obvious invocation of Benjamin in calling the lead character Benny as well. So I would say Ozeki's novel is quite profoundly in dialogue with Benjamin's ideas on objects and collecting. Now, although Ozeki uses a different passage for the epigraph, reading the book of Form and Emptiness, I was reminded of Benjamin's argument that and this is in English translation, but inside the book collector there are spirits which have seen to it that for a collector, and I mean a real collector, a collector as he ought to be, ownership is the most intimate relationship that one can have to objects. Not that they come alive in him, it is he who lives in them. And I like that unsteady ontology. So Benjamin stops short of giving the object agency, but he affords them a kind of dialogic control over the collector, based on the latter's relationship to them. Now, in Ozeki's novel, the speaking objects have voices that seem to emerge from some kind of unclear, kind of hazy zone between the listener and their process of manufacture. So at no point are they definitively positioned as vibrant matter, like Jane Bennett says. Instead, they're infused with the traces of human labor that manufactured or curated them. While all items can speak, man-made items are louder. So if you can see it at the bottom here, there's a quote from the novel. I think it's easier for the made things because the voices of their human makers still cling to them, like a smell that clings to your clothes and you can't get rid of. But unmade things, like trees and pebbles, speak too, only their voices are different. So the disembodied voices, those ghosts that the objects hold, are indexed to their status as made items or unmade items. Now, you could very easily describe this as a dramatization of Marx's commodity fetishism. The objects speak of their manufacture or their co-option into a human system, and the tone of their voice depends on the condition of their making. But this scenario also feels a bit Latourian. The objects become active in the same space as the human who can hear them. Latour says, objects have to enter into accounts. If no trace is produced, they offer no information to the observer. They remain silent and no longer actors. But as much as Ozeki's novel invokes this kind of relation, the emphasis on manufacture here, on how the object's voice might depend on the kind of day that the workers were having back in, quote, Guangdong or Laos, ultimately grounds this relation in something more concrete, more commodity-bound than the mysticism that Latour talks about. And the matrices of haunted objects in the Book of Form and Emptiness seem to fit broadly into two categories. Today I'm going to call them a good network and a bad network, for clarity. The good network is open, dialogic, communicative, imaginative, collaborative. The bad network is overbearing, cacophonous, monologic and monolithic, and it blots out or effaces its dialogic counterpart. Good networks tend to be associated with dialogues with individual objects. So in one sequence, Benny collaborates on writing a story with a wooden pencil. And now he remarks that the voice of the pencil didn't dictate the story, but it allowed him to feel what the pencil was feeling and to channel these feelings into the story. Bad networks, conversely, occur when object voices overwhelm human cognitive ability, capability. They evoke the concept of stuff, of encumbrance, of pollution, of too many things clogging up the world. And Annabelle's news monitoring job is an example of the bad network. She is faced with this constant stream of catastrophic information that she has to make sense of. And once the job gets digitized, she begins the book, she's cutting bits out of newspapers. By the end, she has to sit at a desk with like six screens, and the amount of information is overwhelming. It says, information like this had a life of its own, and once it entered her mind, she couldn't unknow or forget it. So there's not really any dialogue there, it's just a one-way flow of uncontrollable information, much of it about world catastrophe. And while holding this job, Annabelle hoards things, vast amounts of stuff held within a very small apartment, which manifests as a kind of physical example of the bad network, the clogging flow of stuff, which harbors constant threats towards the continuation of humanity itself. So our inability to hold all of this stuff haunts us constantly with the excesses that threaten our ability to live. What's needed is a method that allows us to hold onto this information. A good network, which Ozeki dramatizes in the character of Alice, who is also known as the Aleph. Now, Alice is associated with historical materialism. She hides a postcard of Paul Klee's Angelus Novus, on which is written the passage about the angel of history from Benjamin's thesis on the philosophy of history. She does this regularly, explaining her process to Benny. She says, if you picture the library as a manifestation of the space-time continuum, it's like I'm casting these ephemeral threads across space and time for other people to pick up and follow. I make connections between things. Now, Alice's nickname, the Aleph, invokes Borges's story in which an unlimited amount of information is held within a tiny point. So controlled, in other words, unlike that remorseless and catastrophic information that's constantly overwhelming Annabelle. Now, that web of connection Alice describes evokes Benjamin's concept of the constellation. And it's not a coincidence that Ozeki begins the novel's third section with Benjamin's quote, that ideas are to objects as constellations are to stars. Constellations, a space within which we can hold and manage those connections, recalls how Benny learns to manage the speaking objects that he hears and locate them in a network so as not to become overwhelmed. This also feels to me like an adaptation to go back to Winnicott's transitional object, a site that lies between the body and the world and which things are diffused across an intermediate territory. It is the way then in which we hold on to things that haunt us that determine our ability to manage them. And the space in which Alice establishes these connections is a library, which also contains the haunted objects that are central to Ozeki's novel, which are books. So the novel is narrated by both Benny and the book itself, but it isn't until around halfway through the narrative that Benny becomes aware of the book, which replies to him. Here's the dialogue. Starts with Benny. That voice was you, wasn't it? That was the first time you spoke to me. I could barely hear you through all the noise the paper was making, but I knew you were different from the rest. I didn't know who you were or what you were, I just knew you were mine. To which the book replies, thank you for noticing, and thank you too for what you said just now. I knew you were mine. These are the words every book wants to hear, and it's an interesting question, isn't it? Who belongs to whom? Does the boy write the book, or does the book write the boy? Now, this dialogue takes place in a book bindery, and it lays out that holding and counter-holding that takes place between Benny and the book. Now, I mentioned earlier that the book describes itself as a rhizomatic network. Rhizome, like a constellation, can be decentered. And this constellation is profoundly bound within all the networks of commodity and stuff that we find everywhere we look. Now, of course, the constellation is also, to a certain extent, temporally unbound. And Nozeki's novel invokes temporal juxtaposition, but not in exactly the same way that Benjamin does. Instead, Ozeki is more interested in looking forwards and backwards at the life of an object, how it's created, who owns it, how it wears out, and where it ends up when it's no longer useful. So finally, in holding haunted objects and people in relation throughout the novel, Ozeki also speaks to something about the connection between ephemera and human obsolescence. A subplot of the novel involves excerpts from a self-help book written by a Zen Buddhist nun. One chapter, which is titled Already Broken, concerns a cup belonging to Akon, the nun's teacher. Akon drops the cup, which doesn't break, but her teacher claims that the cup is already broken because it is the nature of a teacup to be broken, and thus one must enjoy it while being aware of its impermanence. Later, when Akon has inherited the cup, the Fukushima earthquake strikes Japan. The cup falls and shatters. The juxtaposition of the washing away of lives and possessions in the earthquake and the impermanence of the cup leads Akon to an understanding of the impermanence of everything and how one must appreciate something while holding an awareness of its obsolescence. But this is not the end of the life of that cup. Akon gets a craftsman to repair the cup with gold and lacquer to hold the pieces together. And this, of course, brings us back to the kintsugi of Chu's fractured skull. Akon's cup is now held together like the skull as a memento mori. So like Chu's sculpture, Ozeki's use of kintsugi indicates that the holding together of the object, the emphasizing of its brokenness, is tied specifically to catastrophe. Both skull and cup are different reminders of human obsolescence, of the idea of humanity as waning, as ephemera. But it's also important to remember that the kintsugi process also highlights the labor used to assemble the object as commodity. The lacquer, whether real or computer-generated, acts as a spur to hold the labor in our minds as a determining factor in the life of the object. The simultaneously broken and unbroken object exists like a ghost, always arriving, always to come, and running through the body of that object. Holding it together is the labor that made it and made it for someone. Thank you.